Good morning, welcome to the Council's Cabinet meeting. Is there any apologies, Gordon?
There are no apologies. With regard to the order of business, it is per the agenda. However, the Chair has agreed that item 6.5 on the agenda, which is the new build council housing, should be taken as basically the first item of public items with no education interest. So that will be considered after the Midlothian Tourism Action Plan, if everybody's agreeable to that.
Should there be any declarations of interest that can be made now or later on in the meeting? And we can now go through the minutes of the last Cabinet meeting held on the 11th of October. And can I draw your attention to one part of it, 5.2.B. Although these minutes are submitted for approval as a correct record of proceedings, with regard to paragraph 5.2b on page 6, colleagues are reminded that following the Council's decision of 27 September this year that the revised standing orders now requires that any proposed seminar receives full Council approval. Thank you. And I've forgot to remind you all that this is a webcast meeting, so thank you very much. And we can now go. Are we all agreed about the minutes in the last Cabinet? Thank you. And go on to 5.1, accreditation of Mayfield Nursery Schools, ICAN provision. Thank you.
Thank you. this report is a follow-on, really. You will be aware that Mayfield was inspected earlier on this year, Mayfield Nursery, and we had an outstanding report from Mayfield Nursery. Well, alongside that outstanding report comes the reaccreditation of the ICAN provision. Members may be aware that there's a specialist provision in Mayfield Nursery that helps with early speech and language delays for children. So this report really outlines the accreditation and shows that the nursery actually achieved accreditation in all 10 areas. So I'll draw members' attention to section 2.3 that outlined the strengths of the nursery across the 10 indicators, and 2.4 saying areas where they comment that work could be better. But if I draw members' attention to 2.5, the conclusion, the creditors acknowledged that the service provided a comprehensive portfolio of evidence which supported observations made on the accreditation. It's worthy of note that the accredited specialist services in Midlothian have consistently provided excellent services for children with speech and language and communication needs for some years. These strengths can be fine-tuned further in line with the suggested areas for development described in the accreditation report. So it shows you that the value that this gives to our children, because it's a Midlothian-wide service that's available. We have invited the head teacher here again just to outline anything within the report that she wants, or for you to ask any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bob, would you like to ask some questions?
This is an excellent report coming in again. And this work is so valuable in that it's at the start of the education process, and the early intervention gives the best outcomes and all the future progress of the children will depend very much on this. One thing I particularly liked was this. The parents, the fourth bullet point in 2.3, parents play an important part in supporting the development of children's program. Involving the parents, I think, getting them into the whole process, for so much more will take place at home as well. And that's where I think this is very important. If anything, I'd like to just hear a bit more about that. How are the parents involved in that? That would be really quite interesting to hear.
As with all multi-agency work, parents are involved in discussion at their child's previous nursery or with a speech and language therapist when they get a referral. And then once the child has a place either in the provision, which is a fully resourced place, or on outreach, which is in their local nursery but supported by our staff, the parent will... For children that come to the fully resourced provision, the speech and language therapist and sometimes education staff, depending on time of year, will do a home visit. So there's that real acknowledgement that the child's first educator is the parent, and the parent is the person that knows the child the very, very best, and that we have things that we can, you know, specialist knowledge that we can do to support the parent and the child, but actually, you know, the primary relationship is between the parent and the child. The parent is involved in coming and learning. They come to an open day, they learn, they meet staff, they learn about the settling in process. Our children who come to the provision, if they live out with Mayfield, get a taxi to nursery, and some of our children are three when they come in the taxi. So it's, that leads to a lot of anxiety for parents. So, but the children love the taxi. They feel very grown up, and actually our children are very, very capable and competent. We work very closely with all the services, including the taxi service, to make sure that works really well for children. We do a home link diary for the children that come to the provision. So every day, these are children with a significant speech, language and communication impairment. So when they go home, they can't necessarily tell the parent what they've been doing. And some children aren't really interested in reporting what they've done. They're more interested in now they're home doing something different. But also these children with a significant speech and language impairment, out of context, it's very difficult to understand what they're saying. So staff write in exactly what the child's been doing each day, anything of any significance. They can ask any questions, and that goes home every day, and the parent writes in it every day, and that comes back. So, you know, say the parents notice something or wants to ask a question, they can. The parents really value that because they really, really know what's happening. Parents can phone our service at any time, and what we tend to find is in the first few weeks they do, and then they start to feel more confident about the processes. They're invited every term to meet with staff, to come and share play with their child in nursery, and to contribute to their multi-agency plan and assessment and their individual education programme.
Excellent, I'm very pleased to hear that. What was the most difficult part maybe in gaining this accreditation for the ICANN service?
Well, it was a 70-page document because it's 10 criteria we must meet. I think what's worthy of note is that we are a multidisciplinary team. So this teacher, a very, very skilled teacher in ICANN, a very, very skilled childcare and development worker, but then also three speech and language therapists who all work one day with us, two in the provision, one on outreach, but all different days. So we never all see each other at one time. So one of the most complicated things was managing to divvy up all the bits that we had to do, make sure that everybody agreed with the self-evaluation and what we were commenting on, and get that together when we don't all work together in the same building. So I think that was actually the most challenging thing. What I think is worth saying is I was heavily involved in Section 10, but that's my section, and then the overview. But what's worth saying is the portfolio, the accreditor said it was an extremely high standard because it wasn't just descriptive, it was evaluative. And actually, nearly every point for development we identified and they ratified.
Thank you. It sounds a very difficult process. I'm glad it's all done. I want to congratulate you on you and just say how proud we are in Midlothian to have this service taking place in Midlothian and running so well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vic Bourne.
Thanks, Leader. It's just more a comment. Once again, congratulations to this nursery on another excellent achievement. It is outstanding, and it is clearly a nursery that is well led. That is very obvious. The area that jumped out of me was on page 23, professional development. It's very clear from such statements as the CPD being linked directly to the children's provision, the fact there is an annual planning day, that CPD is a standing item, and here we hit it right on the nail, the head teacher using timetable plans on a monthly basis, and then, of course, the multi-agency sharing involved. This is a fantastic model, and crucial to this is the support and expertise of the head teacher and the staff involved, and the support and resources that are being provided by Midlothian Council. So, well done, and thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, with all that, I'd just like to move the recommendations in part four.
Thank you very much, and I think we should have a formal round of applause for Lisa Barnes and her team. Thank you. You're welcome to stay to the rest of our meeting, but you can, of course, leave if you wish.
I think I'll get back to nursery.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. I'll take your wishes to the staff. They'll be very, very pleased.
Thank you. Moving on now to the Midlothian Tourism Action Plan, and that's going to be taken by Ian Johnston. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. This is just an update on progress with one of the most important, significant economic sectors in Midlothian, which is tourism, which has seen steady growth over the past few years, and the detailed figures are shown in the report. It takes a lead from the National Strategy for Tourism, which is an up-to-date document, recently revised. The recognition of the importance of tourism in Midlothian is identified strategically through the Community Planning Partnership, Single Midlothian Plan, and in the Economic Development Strategy, otherwise known as Ambitious Midlothian. The plan is, which is appended to the report, is a product of strong partnership with the tourist industry and a very active Midlothian Tourism Forum. And it's the forum which really led the consultations with the tourist industry in Midlothian. And it's a product of a lot of that work. There's a focus on particularly digital capabilities of the industry. There's recognition of the £350,000 for product development and strategic tourism activity through the Borders Rail projects and Borders Rail funding. And there are other key themes as set out in the report, which I won't add to. Just to say that the Tourism Action Plan for 2016-20, that document, it's a solid, collectively agreed action programme to capitalise on the opportunities presented to boost tourism in Midlothian. And the recommendation, therefore, is to endorse that document as the way forward over the next few years, for one of our key economic sectors.
Thank you very much. Jim, Brian?
Thank you, Convener. Thanks, Ian. This is just one of several excellent reports in this Cabinet meeting. The visitor days through the region increased by 4.4%, and the visitor numbers were increased by 2.5%. The economic impact of that is £105 million in 2015, which was up 25.9%, which is remarkable figures. I recently attended a meeting of an events tourism focus as a member of the Midlothian Tourism Forum at Melville Castle. This included organisations from East Lothian, and one of the things that they do is they use the Fringe in Edinburgh to invite them out to East Lothian. And the way they do it is, I won't bore you with that just now, but I'm certainly going to have a look at that and see what if we could piggyback on that that deal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any more questions regarding tourism?
Thanks, Chair. I just wanted to say how great the brochure looks. It's really, really colourful and vibrant, and I think it shouldn't pass without saying so. And thank you and your team for all your hard work.
Thank you, Jim.
Accept the recommendations.
Are we all agreed on the recommendations? Thank you very much. And now we can move on to public items with no education interest, and that one's going to be the new build council housing, the local lettings initiative. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. This report is in respect of the local lettings initiative proposed for the new council housing development at Poulton Street in Bonnyrigg. The council last revised its housing allocation policy during the course of this year, and it proposed changes in that we devise a local lettings initiative for each new build housing development prior to the allocation of those properties in order that we make best use of the housing stock. As detailed in section 2.4, there are currently 2,601 applicants on the housing list for the Bonnyrigg Glasswade area. However, of those, only 655 are actually resident in that immediate area also. Due to the high demand for this area from applicants who are not resident in those communities, others will have to wait some considerable time who are resident there. Similarly, because there's been no new affordable housing built in the area since 2012, we had only 27 lets during the period of 15-16, which adds to that demand. As detailed in Table 1, with the new build of 18 flats, in order to allocate these units, it's recommended that criteria are based on the allocation of the first let of these units, and they are, as listed in Section 2.6, that we allocate suitable ground floor level access housing to medical cases on priority A or B, or subsequently to homeless applicants who are resident in Bonnyrigg, Glasswade and Poulton Hall, and then subsequently the additional properties to those who are under-occupying their tenancies in order that we're able to get a letting chain established for larger properties coming back into the pool. And that, again, would be for people who are resident in the areas of Bonnyrigg, Glasswade and Poulton Hall. We'd then allocate in sequence to those who are on the homeless and general needs areas within those areas, within those locations of Bonnyrigg, Glasswade and Poulton Hall. And then lastly, to those who are not resident in the localities based on the homelessness and general needs applicants, so it is people in housing need who are allocated to these properties. In addition, as we have for the first time within this development produced studio flats, we do not have a rent charge for a studio flat within our system, and we are proposing that the new rent charge of £65.53 is defined for these properties relative to the smaller size, and that in turn is consistent for the size of property as detailed in section 2.7 with other comparable local authority landlords. And I would move to recommendations in section 4 of the report in terms of adopting the local letting initiative and to the reduced rent charge, Chair.
Thank you very much, Kelly.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Kevin. And I'm just reflecting back on the conversations that we had in the Chamber at the time when we changed the housing allocation policy. And I think this really reflects the feeling of all members from all sides and some of the discussions that we had then. But Kevin's right, there's 2,601 people on the housing list for Bonnyrigg and Glasswade, but only 655 of those applicants actually live in the area. So this initiative means that local people will be given priority, which is great news for local people who now won't have to contemplate moving to another area, but also reduces any additional impact that that could have on their jobs and families and also caring relationships that work both ways as well. So very happy to move the recommendations as noted in the paper.
Thank you, Bob.
Yes, I really, speaking as a member for Bonnyrigg, I really welcome this initiative, giving this priority to people that are resident in Bonnyrigg. I quite, being the resident, being the member for Bonnyrigg, I fully understand why Bonnyrigg is such a popular area, of course. I was wanting to ask, the studio flats, by that do you mean the ones that have these open bits? I've been looking at the flats going up in Poulton Street, and I'm actually really impressed with the quality of the build. And it shows up in stark contrast round about it, the building which went up in the 50s or 60s, so goodness knows what. The standard is so much higher, and the accommodation looks like it will be very good. But that, I presume, the studio flats are these bits, have these open and closed. When I say they're open and closed, they're all glazed, and they look very attractive.
Yes, just to confirm for Councillor Constable, it is an open area, open plan living essentially, in comparison to the other properties which have a defined bedroom space in both the one person one bedroom flats and the two person one bedroom flats. The studio flats are all open plan essentially, but they have the same floor area.
Are we agreed these recommendations go forward? Thank you. And now we can revert back to the order of business, which is 6.1, the creation of a Pan-Lothian Local Authority Business Loan Fund John Beveridge.
Okay, thank you. The purpose of this report is to provide Cabinet with an update on progress with the development of a Pan-Scotland Local Authority Loan Fund, or Business Loan Scotland as it's now known. Now, detailed background on the establishment of BLS is set out in Section 2 of the Cabinet Report, and also a detailed business plan which has been placed in the Members' Library. In summary, Business Loan Scotland is a consortium of most of Scotland's 32 local authorities who have come together to provide loan finance of up to £100,000 to new and growing SMEs across Scotland with regional, national or international growth potential. Now, BLS has been designed to complement other funding streams delivered by organisations such as Scottish Enterprise, so it's complementary, not duplicating, and it will play a key part in delivering the Scottish Government's ambitions with regard to business support and growth. Now, with regard to the financing of BLS and its operation, there have been delays, and most recently that's been due to delays with European funding and other uncertainties that have arisen. The initial plan was for the establishment of a fund totalling around £11.75 million, but as the timeline for delivery of the fund shortened, this has had to be scaled back to just over £8 million. Midlothian Council initially intended to put £350,000 into the BLS, but this figure has had to be reduced to £225,000. To give us every chance possible of meeting loan targets and secure our share of European funding. In terms of the operation of BLS locally, it will be delivered through the Business Gateway team, which is based in the Economic Development section, and staff have recently been undertaking loan appraisal training. And has been the practice in the past with the East of Scotland Investment Fund loan applications, Cabinet will have the final approval on any Midlothian-based loan applications. And that £225,000 I referred to, that is ring-fenced for Midlothian businesses. So, as mentioned previously, there's been delays with establishment of BLS, but information received yesterday is that the BLS board will today sign off documentation required by the Scottish Government, and that will then enable logistical issues such as marketing to be progressed, and there's expected to be a ministerial statement on Business Loan Fund sometime this week. Recommendations are as set out in Section 4 of the report, and if anybody has any questions, quite happy to take them or provide further additional information if required.
Thank you very much, John. Jim?
Thanks for that report, John. Another good report for Midlothian. Revisions, as John said, are being presently made to targets such as investment, support to businesses and job creation to reflect the reduced timeline that we now have. But it's actually only 2 years, John, isn't it, that we've got the period to get this loan out?
We're still not clear whether the end date for European funding is going to be 2018 or 2020. And I don't think things are going to be cleared up on that until analysis of the autumn statement later on this week. We're just not sure what the end date is, whether it's going to be 2018 or 2020. But there are guarantees in place for the Scottish Government. It's just the end date, it's just unclear.
Thanks. In that case, I move to paragraph 4 recommendations and a proposal.
Thank you very much, Vic.
Thanks, Leader. Although this is listed under non-education, the fact is that in terms of positive destinations, in terms of young people's employment, I think this is a very, very important paper. I think we all recognise the strength of the German Mittelstand system, whereby small and medium firms receive considerable local support from authorities, banks. The greatest hindrance has been illustrated recently when there have been discussions in the UK about bank lending is that while large institutions have done very, very well, the smaller institutions, due to the risk that they present, have not done so well. This is where Britain is going to grow. We are seeing more and more people going into single employment, setting themselves up. I think this is an exceedingly positive paper that we in Midlothian will be supporting good and practical schemes. So I really, really do welcome this paper in terms of the future employment of our young people in Midlothian. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're agreed the recommendations. Thank you. And we can now move on to 6.2 Easter Bush Improvement District update by Ian Johnston.
This is a progress report on the moving towards the establishment of a business improvement district in the Easter Bush cluster of science-based education, research and employment. People will be familiar with the Easter Bush cluster and the fact that it's somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 jobs in the science-based industries are there. This has come forward through part of an overall strategy set out in the Easter Bush Framework Master Plan, which was prepared and published in 2012. And the bid can act to support a lot of the promotional themes of that document, of that strategy. And we're talking about things like branding, marketing, signage, environmental improvements. But that's only just a few of the broader canvas of activities which could be covered under the Business Improvement District. The proposal has already been considered informally through the Easter Bush Development Board, which was a product of the Framework Master Plan. And that development board includes representatives from all of the main stakeholders and also includes representation from Midlothian Council. There's clearly a significant degree of support in principle for that. So the aim would now be to move to the next stage, which is stage one of the formal process, by establishing a business improvement district group, by consulting with all of the relevant parties. If that's favourable, then you move to preparing a detailed business plan, further consultation, and then the formal ballot. So it'll reflect what's happened in Pennycook Town Centre. As you know, we've now got an established BID in Pennycook Town Centre, having been through that process. So that's a total of about 18 months for those two stages. The funding is in place to support that up to the point of ballot. So there's no asking here for further funding. And then, of course, the funding of the BID is through effectively a precept on the contributions which are made by the various partners at the Easter Bush area. Just a brief thing, there's a reference to a map in to accompany the report. That map's not shown. Really, the boundary the boundary of the BID area is really something that comes through a consultation process. So it was perhaps erroneous to indicate a map at this stage. That needs to be part of the process. Otherwise, the recommendations are as stated in the report. Chair, happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Thanks for that, Ian. The Easter Bush bid is probably, well, is the only one involving a science park in the UK, possibly in the world. It's a very exciting concept, and the project worker who's just done Pennycook is quite experienced now, and I'm sure that Derek will have something to say on that in a minute. I mean, we've got Edinburgh University, Royal Dick Vet, and other big companies there, and we're really looking forward to getting this off the ground and moving. It's not going to be easy, but I'm quite sure that we'll get through.
Thank you. Derek, would you like to chat?
Thank you. Well, you'd be surprised if you mentioned Pennycook bid and I didn't say something. No, it's just that this is really an exciting venture. This has been already said. I mean, it's the first one in the bid in the UK to be around a science zone. So I think that's excellent. And also bearing in mind that the Bush estate in itself and all that it's made up is the biggest in Europe. So that's, I think, gives us a great opportunity. And bear in mind, if you look through the part, it's at 3.2 on page 63, you know, where it's hoped that the bid could be the potential mechanism that will be used to source funding and provide revenue for the delivery of a number of the strategic objectives contained in the Bush Framework Master Plan. I mean, if you look at what's happened in Pennycook, you know, mainly around the bid, I think, because there's a business improvement district that's helped the Development Trust with the storehouse, where they managed to source £150,000 of Scottish Government funding for that. And there's other smaller projects, okay, on cycling and things like that, but a lot of them are driven around the Pennycook First, the Business Improvement District. So there's potential there. And I do notice that Ian or John may be able to say, but if we look back on the previous report on the Business Loan Fund, there is mention in there of the possibility of, you know, the Science Park at Easter Bush perhaps benefiting from that. But I would imagine that the Business Improvement District, if it goes ahead, would be crucial for that too. Would that be a advantage, you know, if it goes ahead?
I think, Mr. Privy Chair, they're all elements in an overall strategy to just keep the profile of that Easter Bush area up. And you know, even you know, other links, like, for example, what's happening through the local development plan with the road access, the potential acceleration of that through hopefully City Deal funding, all of these things come together in just keeping the development of the businesses there on the university on the front foot.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Yeah. And just a quick word on, now, as we know, Edward Linton-Smith has been taken on as the coordinator of this, and his experience that he's gained through the Pennycook bid, where he was a coordinator and we achieved the vote there. He works at the moment for Linlithgow bid part-time, and he's also he's just seen a successful renewal of the Falkirk bid, so he has got experience there of this sort of thing. So I'm looking forward to the project getting off the ground and on.
Thank you. So we're all agreed these recommendations. Thank you. Moving on to the next report, 6.3, report for the Scottish Ministers on compliance with climate change duties, and that's going to be Peter. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. This is a report to inform Cabinet of the Council's statement of compliance with its climate change duties for 2015-16. A copy of the statement is to be submitted to the Scottish Government, which is attached to the paper. Since 2007, all Scottish local authorities have been signatories to Scotland's climate change declaration, publicly committing themselves to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, taking steps to adapt to climate change, and working in partnership on climate change. Following a 2014-15 pilot, reports for 2015-16 are required by statute to be submitted to the Scottish Ministers by the 30th of November 2016. This requirement has replaced the previously voluntary regime, which was in existence from 2008. Public bodies report by completing an online form, the format and content of which are prescribed by regulations and set by the Scottish Government. The statement sets out the Council's position with regard to its governance, management and strategy with regard to climate change, its level of carbon emissions and its commitment to the National Adaptation Programme. In general terms, the Council's own level of carbon dioxide emissions is reducing as a result of its effort to make its buildings more efficient by rationalising its estate and by improving its management of its waste. Although the overall picture is a positive one, the level of emissions from staff business travel and staff commuting to work is increasing. And the recommendations are as set out in the report.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Thanks for that, Peter. Yeah. The reason for the report, as Peter just said, is that we need to report to the Scottish Government by the end of the month. And I think that if you look at paragraph 3.9, the five priorities there of drafting a corporate climate change and sustainable development action plan has been done. Further progress, management of climate risks in accordance with adoption of Scotland's five steps, managing your climate risks, and the other three are as laid out in 3.9. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are we agreed to these recommendations? Thank you. And next one is the Tyne ESC Leader Programme 2014-20, and that is John Beveridge.
Right, thank you, Chair. This report has been prepared to update Cabinet on progress with the Tyne ESC Leader Programme, which covers designated parts of Mid Lothian and East Lothian. Now, the Leader Programme is one element of the Scotland Rural Development Programme, and it's basically a bottom-up method of delivering support to communities for rural development. Grants are awarded by local action groups, or LAGs, to projects that support delivery of an approved local development strategy and a business plan, and Councillor Bryan is Mid Lothian Council's representative on the Tyne ESC LAG. Now, the aims and objectives of LEADER at a national and local level are set out in Section 2 of this report, so I'm not proposing to go into that in detail. With regard to the financing and operation of the Tyne ESC programme, the programme's got a value of just under £3.5 million and it's overseen by three staff based in the Council's Economic Development section, and I also sit on an accountable bodies group which is coordinated by the Scottish Government, and that looks at issues such as auditing of the programme and other key issues. Now, the first Tyne ESC LAG meeting was held on the 31st of October and six applications were approved, totalling just under £268,000. Now, at that time of the LAG meeting, and as mentioned in section 3.1 of the report, the LEADER programme was effectively suspended to new bids beyond the UK Government's autumn statement, which will come out later this week. But I can report that in early November, and also at the accountable bodies meeting on the 8th of November, the suspension was lifted by the Scottish Government, although we're still awaiting clarity, as we are with Business Loan Scotland, on what the actual end date of the LEADER programme is going to be. But in any event, the suspension's been lifted, which is good news for local projects, and the next LAG meeting scheduled for the 10th of February 2017, and a number of applications are already in the pipeline, and I'll be coming forward to that LAG meeting, potentially about five or six from Mid Lothian, which is really good news. Recommendations are as set out in section 4 of the report, and again, I'm happy to take any questions or provide detailed follow-up information to any queries.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks for that again, John. Yeah, I'm glad that the thing has been lifted and we can now get moving on this. The last LEADER programme was run by East Lothian, and this has now been run by Mid Lothian, and there's three staff members who are allocated to that task. The Tyne ESC LEADER set-up, the committee, is 64% of non-public and 35% of public on the board, or the committee, rather. So I recommend the recommendations.
Thank you very much. Are we agreed the recommendations go forward? Thank you. And then moving on to the next item we have is 6.6, is the healthcare budget pressures. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The purpose of this report is to provide background to the financial pressures as reported in the Quarter 2 performance report for health and social care budgets, and also to provide members with information on the actions that's been taken to address these pressures. Paragraph 2, Section 2 sets out the background. In essence, integration has happened. IGBs have been set up because of the challenge facing both health and social care services to deliver financially sustainable services in the face of the demographic changes that are happening. That's the raison d'etre of integration fundamentally, but also to do so by transferring the model from a highly institutionalised model to more personalised services at home for people. So this report really gets to the heart of the challenges that integration must address. The paragraph 2.3 highlights the recent Audit Scotland report in relation to social care, and again that report urged an increase in the pace of transformation that's required, particularly around the models of care within social care services. According to the projections in that report, if everything stays the same, adult social care budgets would require an extra £8 million by 2020. The report also highlights the need for better engagement with the public and a new understanding of the challenges that are being faced in order to achieve those sustainable solutions. Section 2.3 onwards highlights the issues around the current projected overspend. The spend is, we're looking at a 1.4 million on a budget of 38 million, but the most significant area of overspend is the 1.4 million against the resource panel budget of 29 million. And the resource panel budget is the one that is spent as a response to demand for assessed need in relation to packages of care throughout the population. The Council is committed to meeting eligibility criteria, that is, where need is deemed to be either critical or substantial, the Council is committed to meeting that need. There is also overspend in relation to in-house services, 2.74 in in-house home care and 2.72 in care homes. That's offset by underspend in other areas of budget. There are also, and considering the wider health and social care budgets, there's also pressures within the prescribing budget, and also in the years going forward, there's a requirement to make further efficiencies within the NHS with the side of the budget as well, as the NHS board seeks to balance its budget in relation to future demand. In terms of the underlying causes for this overspend, the projection at the moment is based on the committed budget, and that is the calculations that are based on care packages as they exist today. We know from year to year that that spend can be very variable, and at this point in the year it's not unusual to record a high spend. However, having said that, the current level of overspend is more serious than we've seen before. The reason why we see variation is a continual change in care arrangement as people needs change. And one of the key things that we are doing in terms of addressing it is looking at our systems to look at how we can build the flexibility of reporting into our systems so that it can give more accurate predictions around budget spend. In terms of, there are a number of areas that we're looking at in terms of the current pressures. There is an overspend in, some of it can be attributed to what we went into the financial year with. We went into the financial year, although we had an overspend of 400K last year, we actually went into this financial year with an overcommitment of 900K. And we were concerned about that in relation to some of our high-level packages, and have been working to had targeted work around individual packages, which we have now achieved. However, what we've seen since is an overspend in older people's services, and that can be attributed to the failure of one of our external providers in the West. And their inability to meet their contractual arrangements meant that we had to rely on our in-house service to meet that demand instead. That arose to an additional 600 extra hours per week, but that was funded on a different basis and is more expensive than the external provider. This also caused pressures in relation to our delayed discharge and how we use our care home budget as well. So it's the consequences of that breakdown that has caused pressures in other areas of the system. However, the area of greatest concern for us is the spend in relation to adults. That's the spend on from young adults through to 65 years of age. And what we've seen over the last year is a 26% growth in that area of spend. It's gone up from something like 13 to 16 million. There are also a number of other factors that have contributed directly to that. We had, in our procurement arrangements, we had an arrangement whereby we procured overnight cover, particularly for people who are in individualised packages of care, and we had a sleepover rate for that. We had an employment tribunal ruling that said that any member of staff who was doing a sleepover now needs to be paid the minimum wage, and subsequent to that, we're now looking at them being paid the living wage. So that caused a very significant increase in those care packages for that group of individuals. We've also seen the introduction of the living wage, $8.25 an hour for social care staff. That comes into effect from the 1st of October. And although we estimate at the moment that we're looking at 600k for that. That's the we only have funding. That's for the six-month effect. Next year we'll have full-year effect. It's anticipated that that will be taken into account in the Scottish Government financial settlement, but that has yet to be confirmed, and the exact amount of it as well. We're still unsure of it. Undoubtedly, the resource panel is tasked with meeting demand that is unpredictable, and that's one of the key issues in terms of managing this budget. But underneath this, there's also issues around workforce challenges. In reality, our model of care is creating a demand for workforce that we're unable to fulfil. All of our providers have difficulty recruiting staff, and that's causing a level of pressure within the system that's leading to breakdown in some arrangements. So we're needing to be mindful that this isn't just about financial resources, it's about human resources as well. It's about the number of people, even with the payment of the living wage, it's about the numbers of people that are within our population who are interested in and who are suitable for care work. And with our shift in demographic as a community, that's becoming more challenging. I would say the workforce issues are particularly marked around the East Coast, particularly in the Lothians. It's probably, we've seen an acceleration over the last probably 12 months, but the City of Edinburgh has been experiencing this for a number of years. And I guess it's also related to the economic buoyancy of our local economies. In terms of our recovery, there is intensive work going on with our systems team and our finance teams around an overhaul of our systems to make sure that our reporting has the flexibility to adapt to the kind of the way we're developing packages in that kind of very personalised way. And we're making good progress in relation to that with our colleagues from Integrated Service Support. The other key area that we're looking at is about the resource allocation. While we're committed to meeting critical and substantial need, the challenge for us is to move away from that need being met by services and increasingly looking at how what families can do to support individuals, what the community can do to support individuals, and also real alternatives for to service provision, things like people with mental health issues. Employment, we know, delivers better outcomes than services. So it's about people being able to access those kind of everyday community supports that are much less expensive than services, but we have a lot of good evidence that they also provide better outcomes. So that's the key in terms of the shift, and also becoming much more focused on risk and our approach to risk. Services can never eliminate risk. Our task must be to reduce risk to an acceptable level. So there's a lot of scrutiny going on at the moment in terms of professional practice in this area. And obviously, we're working closely with our professional advisors as well in relation to this. There's intensive work ongoing in relation to reviewing existing care packages. because of the volume of work that's coming through the door, we need to make sure that we're keeping up to date with reviewing, because needs change, sometimes they deteriorate, but also we need to look more and more at short-term packages that will deliver outcomes where we can then go back in and reduce those packages. So there's an intensive piece of work going on at the moment in terms of reviewing care packages. Fundamentally, what we need to do is redesign the models of care, referring back to that Audit Scotland report. We've seen a growth in very intensive 24/7 packages for individuals. They are intensive in terms of both staffing, but they're also very intensive in relation to financial resources as well. We're looking at our learning disability services. We're looking at things like, I referred earlier to sleepovers and nighttime support, looking at how we can use assistive technology to provide people with the security that they need in a different way that is less staff and resource intensive. We're looking at travelling arrangements. We're looking at more shared travelling arrangements. Again, it's about sometimes arrangements are set up at a particular point in time when people are younger, but it's really about focusing on supporting people in terms of teaching people to travel safely, either to travel independently or helping people to manage shared travel arrangements. We're also looking at how we can work with people to have more shared support arrangements. So rather than a one-to-one arrangement for an individual, working with groups of individuals where they have shared interests, where there's times that we're able to look at them having shared arrangements with other people. And again, that can have benefits in terms of social skills, etc. The support of the voluntary sector is really crucial in this, in terms, and also the other community supports that are out there in our communities and trying to get us to that place with this new model of care. I guess one of the biggest challenges that we face is how we work sensitively with family carers and the people who are dependent on our services, and how we work at a pace that is appropriate to them and their needs around achieving that shift. What we need to do isn't dissimilar from what the Chief Medical Officer has talked about when she's talked about the need to move to realistic medicine. It's getting that balance right between the input of services and the outcomes that we want to achieve for individuals. In relation to the recommendations, I would draw Cabinet's attention to the recommendations in 4.1. In relation to the second recommendation, really raising that matter because there's an acknowledgement that our challenge isn't just to get the current in-year spend down, but we've also got to achieve that challenge, which is the 1.5 million that is coming out of the Council's offer to the IGB next year. And I guess it's really about ensuring that there is a dialogue between the Council and the IGB around the phasing of that, and how at this point we'll probably be in a better position in certainly by January to have a more realistic understanding of how we're going to achieve the full extent of those efficiencies, and we'll be in a better position at that stage to have that dialogue. But at this stage, as a partnership, we are committed to achieving both. I would also suggest to Cabinet that they may also want to refer this report to Performance and Scrutiny Committee. Happy to respond to any questions, Chair.
Thank you very much. Everyone's facing budget pressures, not just this budget, but these are some of our most vulnerable and needy people, so we have to take special measures to ensure that they are always safe. And I understand that it's very difficult to predict demand, but wonder if we could improve our planning or anticipation of what's coming forward, and also if we could be regularly update on how the work you've identified is going to address the issues that we are facing, so we can avoid this situation in future years.
Thank you, Chair. Planning is key, and I think particularly around when we look at older people's services, when we're, although we're seeing the pressures that are coming from failure in the independent sector, the work that we've done there in transformation in the past is standing us in good stead. We estimate that our reablement service alone is saving us over £1 million every year because of the way that it designs packages. And I think what we want to do move to is having a similar process in place in relation to the design of other packages for young adults so that we're getting that balance right between resource and outcomes. We're also looking at a revised policy in this area as well. So there's policy development going on. But the planning around a different model in relation to overnight support, the planning around a different model in relation to how we allocate resource for support is really, really critical. And sorry, just in relation to the other issue, I'd be very happy to continue to bring back a further report early in the year in terms of our financial planning in this area.
Thank you. And it was there was one more question I had in regard to the failure we had of one of our external care at home providers, and wonder if there's anything we can do in procurement that would tighten that up to so as to prevent that happening again.
The failure in relation to that, there were a number of factors that fed into it. One was in relation to self-directed support, where an existing provider, and again, we've seen it very recently in West Lothian, where they moved into a procurement exercise. What we've done in procurement is we have divided Midlothian up into different areas so that we have one provider in each area. And the advantages of that is we don't have providers competing with each other for staff. And we also cut down the amount of time that staff will spend travelling so that we have a more localised travelling workforce. What happened is one of our providers in the West who wasn't successful actively worked with people who were receiving services to encourage them to move to self-directed support and to stay with them as a provider. And that meant that the new provider came in, had a much smaller contract, and the staff stayed with the previous provider as well, and the new provider never met the challenge of getting enough staff to really deliver the service as was required. I think, I am in discussions with our procurement and our finance team at the moment around, there have been significant developments in procurement over the last few years. We originally took a lot of money out of the system through procurement, but we're now reaching the stage where we're seeing across the country a level of service failure that in some cases can be brought, can be linked directly to the procurement process itself. So we are needing to look at that whole area. Some areas are now adopting a different approach and going out with a fixed price rather than saying going out to the market seeking different prices from different providers. They're working on what is an established price and then going out and looking for providers on that basis. And that's something we're looking at, the pros and cons at the moment. The other area in relation to procurement where we've had difficulty is where the renegotiation around the living wage has meant that contracts have been opened up again, contracts that were sealed and in place for a number of years, and we've had to review contracts, and that's also brought other cost pressures as well. But it is an area that we're actively looking at.
Thank you. I think it's reasonable to refer this to the PRS, and we can add that to the recommendations, and we're happy to go ahead with the other ones too. Thank you very much. There is no other public items and no private items for education or non-educational interests. So that brings our meeting to a close, and I wish you all a successful journey home. Thank you.